Welcome to the Madden America podcast, your source for science, psychiatry, and social justice. Hello, this is James, and welcome to the podcast. And this week, we turn our attention to conflicts of interest and new research from the British Medical Journal. Madden America has previously examined the problem with conflicts of interest in research, but this time we extend that to look at the potential effect of COIs on diagnostic tools such as the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. Joining me today are Lisa Cosgrove and Brian Piper, two of the authors of a paper which appeared in the BMJ. The paper is entitled Undisclosed Financial Conflicts of Interest in the DSM-5 TR Cross-Sectional Analysis, and it was published in January 2024. Lisa Cosgrove is a clinical psychologist and professor at the University of Massachusetts Boston, where she teaches courses on psychiatric diagnosis and psychopharmacology. A former research fellow at the Edmund J. Safra Center for Ethics, Harvard University, her research addresses the ethical and medical legal issues that arise in organized psychiatry because of academic-industry relationships. She is co-author with Robert Whittaker of Psychiatry Under the Influence, Institutional Corruption, Social Injury, and Prescriptions for Reform. Brian Piper is an Associate Professor of Neuroscience at Geisinger Commonwealth School of Medicine in Scranton, PA, and an Associate Professor of Neuroscience. He maintains an active program of research in the pharmacoepidemiology of controlled substances, including opioids, cannabinoids, and other controlled substances, behavioral neurology methods development, and quantitative medical ethics. Lisa and Brian, welcome, both of you. Thank you so much for joining me for the Madden America podcast. I'm delighted to have you on to get to talk a little bit about your work.
Thank you. We're delighted to be here.
Yeah, thrilled to be here.
Great, thank you. So to get us underway, I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about yourselves and perhaps, you know, your kind of areas of research interest. So Lisa, could we start with you?
I'm a clinical psychologist by training. I'm also affiliated with the Ethics Center at our university, University of Massachusetts Boston, and the research that we do broadly looks at the ways in which academic industry relationships can have a corrupting influence on medicine and in particular on psychiatry, psychiatric diagnostic and treatment guidelines.
Great, thank you. And Brian?
Yeah, I'm Brian Piper, Associate Professor of Neuroscience at Geisinger Commonwealth School of Medicine. And then I also have a secondary appointment with the Center for Pharmacy Innovation and Outcomes, also with Geisinger in Danville, Pennsylvania. And I have two lines of research. One is on conflicts of interest in medicine broadly, looking at influential sources that are used by physicians and other healthcare providers, information sources. And then I also have another line of research on pharmacoepidemiology, looking at the increasing use of medications, whether it's for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, for depression, or for a wide variety of other psychological disorders.
Thank you both so much. So we're here today to talk a little bit about conflicts of interest, and in particular, a piece of work that you both did examining the effect of financial conflicts of interest and the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. But before we get to the paper itself, I think people out there listening probably have a broad sense that conflicts of interest can be bad. But I wondered if we could kind of talk a little bit about specifically why they can be such a problem.
If we think about the history of psychiatry for a little bit, I think people are pretty well acquainted with Sigmund Freud and his very close relationship with cocaine. And cocaine, I know it's mostly associated with being a recreational drug that smoked, but it also was and continues to be, it's still used as a medical drug, particularly for eye surgeries. And Sigmund Freud was a major, major advocate. You know, he wrote about this topic in the late 1800s. He wanted his friends to use this drug. He wanted his family members to use his drug. He was also a major user for an extended period of time. And people want to know, you know, when medical historians say, hey, you know, this particular person got appreciable amount of money from a pharmaceutical company, in this case, Merck and Park Davis, they want to know, you know, how much money it is. And when he says that there's no cravings associated with cocaine, you really want to know, hey, is that advice coming from his expert opinion, using this drug quite extensively, or do those conflicts of interest, does that tug of the bottom line and the money that he was receiving, does that influence the medical care that he was providing? And that was an issue then, and that continues to be an issue to this day.
The only thing I would add to Brian's excellent point is that conflicts of interest can incur implicit bias. You know, it's part of the human condition to have biases and to remain blissfully unaware of them. And we often assume, quite wrongly, that the scientific process can protect us from those implicit biases. And so one of the reasons why conflicts of interest in medicine are problematic is because they do lead to these implicit biases, what some have referred to as pro-industry habits of thought. And in terms of the DSM, it hasn't been that long that we've had this medicalized view of emotional distress. And the medicalized view of emotional distress is certainly an industry-friendly perspective because it leads to the development of psychotropic medications as interventions, but it's not necessarily in the public's best interest.
Yeah, absolutely understood. And of course, some of the people involved will probably come on to talk a bit more about it, but some of the people involved are what are known as key opinion leaders, aren't they? So, you know, they're really quite important figures in the field of psychiatry. And one gets a sense that they're acting almost as a marketing tool rather than a kind of tool of science.
Yes, that's a very important point. There are key opinion leaders in all areas, right? Nike knows that to sell sneakers, they're going to tap a very famous athlete. And in much the same way that Nike knows that, so too do the pharmaceutical company executives.
Thank you. So if we turn to the paper then, it's entitled Undisclosed Financial Conflicts of Interest in the DSM-5-TR Cross-Sectional Analysis, and it was published in the British Medical Journal in January 2024. So I guess I'd like to ask, you know, what was the question that you were trying to answer with your work, and how did you go about the research to answer that question?
Yeah, I could start with kind of a little broader perspective on the research question. So I'm coming at it particularly from the drug side of things, from the pharmacology. I teach pharmacology for medical students, for residents, and for graduate students. And influential materials can have a very profound effect on the practice of medicine. Members of my team, we've been doing studies for the past, you know, 8 or 10 years looking at point of care databases like UpToDate and DynaMed, looking at Medscape. We've been looking at a lot of different information resources like the New England Journal, Journal of American Medical Association. And the general pattern is that the conflicts of interest is really important. The National Academy of Medicine says, you know, if you're going to put together clinical practice guidelines that you can trust, you should have authors whenever possible that don't have a conflict of interest. And the American Psychiatric Association, in their publications, they require that authors disclose conflicts of interest. So we were a little bit surprised, maybe even a little bit mystified, that the American Psychiatric Association, in publishing the DSM, didn't have the most recent version of the DSM, some sort of preface, some sort of information, even in small font. I'd be happy with it in 0.2 font about the conflicts of interest of the contributors to this. And that wasn't present. That information wasn't available. So we wanted to help them out, if you will, and get this information into the public domain.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was the Open Payments database you used, is that right?
Yeah, so this is an amazing resource. This has been available for the past few years. At the risk of a digression, I would suggest that every listener, before you go to your primary care provider, your psychiatrist, your physician assistant, your nurse practitioner, do a quick Google search for CMS Open Payments. And, you know, with a little bit of practice, ideally, if you know their middle initial, you can go to the CMS Open Payments and look up their conflicts of interest. And that's what we did for the 160 or so contributors to the DSM.
That's fascinating. And this might be a difficult question to answer, but you know, if these people are aware that anyone can go and find that information, and they're obviously happy to accept industry money and for it to be presented as public information, you know, do they not think it's an issue? You know, do they not mind that this information is out there for researchers like you to kind of grab and present to the public?
That's a good question. And it is curious, because when Shelley Krimsky and I first did our study in 2000, published it in 2006 on conflicts of interest in the DSM-IV, we found that almost 60% in total of the authors had financial conflicts of interest. Then a year before the DSM-5 came out, in 2012, we published a study looking at the conflicts of interest in the DSM-5. And at that point, the APA did institute a conflict of interest policy. I'd like to think that maybe our 2006 study had a small role to play in that, but they did, at any rate, they did have this policy. And yet what we found was approximately the same percentage of panel members had ties, and the ties were particularly strong in those areas for which pharmacological treatment was the first line intervention. And so, as Brian was saying, it is curious that, you know, with the DSM-5 TR, given our past publications and their conflict of interest policy for the 2005, that they didn't have one for the TR version. And as Brian was saying, what's unique to this study, even though in many ways it's a replication of our previous work, we were able to use the Open Payments Database, which started in 2014. So Shelley and I weren't able to do that in 2006 or 2012. So what Brian was saying is so important, that as long as you're US-based, you can look up any physician and see not only how much money they've received, but the type of funding. As you were referring to, James, you can see if they were, in fact, key opinion leaders.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. And can you remind me of the total amount that you found again? Was it $14 million? Was that right?
$14 million, completely undisclosed. So the readers of the DSM wouldn't know this. So the American Psychiatric Association, unlike in their journals where there's this information, not the number amount, but at least, you know, that the names of the companies are listed, none of this information was available.
And, you know, again, this might be difficult for me to explain being a layperson, but I guess in reading the paper, one thing that struck me as really important was that if there was some regulation mechanism at the diagnostic end, that might help matters. If there were a test, say, that when you were given a diagnosis, there was a, you know, a biological test that you could go and find, then that itself might regulate the kind of increasing trend in diagnoses. But because we appreciate that psychiatric diagnoses in the main are quite subjective things, then if someone is looking to the DSM and, you know, doesn't necessarily realize that there's been industry influence on it, then there's nothing at the back end to kind of regulate the number of diagnoses coming through. Is that right?
Yeah, that's completely right. So of the 300 or so, depending on how you count it, disorders in the psychiatric Bible in the DSM, there's only a handful that have an objective laboratory measure. You know, and that's including an objective laboratory measure, defining it pretty broadly to include something like a scale when it's used, you know, like a weight scale for anorexia, or, you know, there is for narcolepsy, you know, hypercretin deficiencies occurs in about a third of patients. But for the vast, vast preponderance, this is based on very expertly, very carefully obtained subjective information.
And there are actually no biomarkers for any of the DSM disorders. So Brian's right. And I just want to emphasize that point.
It was interesting to me to see, so you've done a breakdown of, you know, how much money was coming in per kind of group of disorders, if you like. And it was quite interesting to see that I think the biggest one was medication-induced movement disorders, you know, which kind of, I guess, clearly speaks that there seems to be an avenue there that the pharmaceutical industry is quite interested in exploring and therefore is trying to maybe pump money into it to, you know, to stimulate some demand, if you like.
Yes. And again, there are two points I'd like to emphasize. One is, once again, what we found were the categories for which there was the most industry money were the categories of disorders for which pharmacological treatments are the first line intervention. But the other point that I really want to emphasize is that we're not in any way suggesting wrongdoing or any sort of quid pro quo mechanism at play here. Again, the issue is implicit bias, that it creates this, you know, as I mentioned, pro-industry habit of thought, which reinforces a medicalized view of emotional distress. And so it's not the case where we think that there's any sort of backdoor deals, but rather, you know, by medicalizing distress, we deflect attention away from the upstream causes, such as austerity policies, unsafe or inadequate housing, food scarcity, etc.
Is this a problem that's particularly prevalent in psychiatry, or is this a problem that affects all kind of sectors of medicine?
Yeah, I would argue it's a really broad problem, that this isn't limited to psychiatry. We've done other work looking at journals, cardiology journals. We've done some other work on oncology journals. This is really a broad issue. I continue to do these studies, beating on this drum that self-reporting conflicts of interest doesn't work. And I submit these manuscripts, and some of the anonymous reviewers come back and it's like, yeah, we've known this. We've known this for a decade, that self-reporting doesn't work, that mandating reporting is the way to go. But journals and a lot of sources continue to rely on this. And I don't want to disparage my gender at all, but people with a Y chromosome, they have a particular difficulty. We keep on seeing this over and over in studies where we've looked at, you know, contributors to this point of care database like Medscape, and so and so will look it up, and it's like, oh, you've received money for all the major products for Parkinson's disease. You write an article for Parkinson's disease, and you know, even though you receive $400,000, you say you have no conflicts of interest. That's really curious. And I'd argue this isn't just an American issue. We really should be grateful that America has a tool like the CMS Open Payments that's been mandatory for, you know, a decent period of time, where some other countries it's more recent or is non-mandatory. So in some ways, America, we have our challenges, but at least we have some tools to begin to deal with this, whereas some other countries are less further along in having tools like this.
Understood. And you know, your study appeared in the British Medical Journal, which is a pretty prestigious publication. It only came out in January. It's March now. But I wondered what kind of feedback you've had since you published your article.
The APA did write an editorial immediately after it was published, and they didn't disagree with any of our findings. They tried to say that these conflicts of interest didn't affect them, which again is problematic because it's just part of the human condition to have implicit bias. The other thing I just wanted to circle back to, thinking about what Brian had just said, is what's unfortunate are the downstream effects of the conflicts of interest. And by that I mean the fact that psychiatrists and other prescribers are not receiving balanced and accurate information, because we know that there's certainly a connection between industry funding and pro-industry results. And unfortunately, the peer review process is not robust enough to protect against that. So like Brian, I teach the psychopharmacology class to master's and doctoral students, and we did a study a few years back looking at conflicts of interest in psychopharmacology texts, and they're rampant there. So one has to be concerned about, you know, our readers, our medical students, doctoral students receiving accurate and balanced information from the text. I would argue that when there are lots of conflicts of interest on the part of the authors, we need to be skeptical about the information that's being disseminated.
Yeah, and I'd just like to extend upon Lisa's comment. So Lisa's done, you know, a really fantastic series of studies on this topic. And we did get, you know, some interest in media organizations, you know, in podcasts like this. I had some particularly interesting comment on Reddit, of all places. It was posted on the Science thread, and it's a fairly snarky place. Some of the people were just like, ho-hum, we know this, kind of yawn, you know, which is like, yes, I mean, it's getting out to the general public, you know, but this is an unfortunate situation where if the American Psychiatric Association loses trust, it's really, really difficult to gain that back. There's an easy solution, you know, to prevent that. You know, there's tools like Open Payments. They can list the link in the next version of the DSM. I'm young enough that you know, and Lisa's energetic enough, we will be there to do this for the next version of the DSM. So, but we hope we don't have to. We hope they will do that for us.
And to Brian's point about the sort of ho-hum response, you know, I think most people, if you told them that eating a candy bar, a chocolate bar, increased longevity and increased your overall health, if they found out that that study was funded by Hershey, most people would be certainly skeptical. They wouldn't have to be schooled in conflicts of interest. And yet, sadly, when it comes to medicine, I don't think people are as aware as they could be of the ways in which these conflicts can result in imbalanced and sometimes inaccurate information.
You talked a little bit about the next version of the DSM. So if we look to the future, you know, is it sufficient to have these conflicts writ large in the work? Or should we go further than that and examine some complete split between industry and how it contributes to research and development and all those kind of things? You know, is it enough just to name these things, or should we go further than that?
Definitely, we should go further.
Yeah, just disclosing isn't sufficient. Just disclosing really, I mean, it's the management of these conflicts of interest is really important. And again, my dream and the National Academy of Medicine's dream would be, hey, you should get people that don't have conflicts of interest. That would be really important in this. The other suggestion is, as the former chair of DSM-IV has indicated, 80% of psychiatric meds, their prescriptions aren't coming from psychiatrists, they're coming from general practitioners. Why not have general practitioners and other people that are involved in this process? I know there are a little bit of non-psychiatrists, but it's very, very limited. So no conflicts of interest, and have other voices that are on those DSM working groups and panels to have those other folks better represented would be my hope.
Do you think there's any reasonable chance of that happening?
I've been a little underwhelmed. I mean, I'm a neuroscientist who came, you know, from the decade of the brain and was really excited about, you know, learning more about the biological underpinnings of psychiatric disorders. And even when there's been progress in some psychiatric disorders for genetic components, you know, the number of geneticists on the DSM panels is extremely limited. It's continues to be underwhelming. So I'm not super optimistic, frankly.
I think the DSM could be a more helpful diagnostic instrument if you included, as most guidelines do in other areas of medicine, if you included the people who are affected by the conditions. Because we have to remember that the creators of the DSM have not just the authority to change symptomatology or add a new disorder, but they also have the authority to narrow diagnostic categories or even take out homosexuality would be a good example. They have the authority to be able to take out previously included disorders.
I don't know if there's anything else that you felt that we should really talk about that I hadn't kind of got to.
Two things come to mind. One is there's the issue of guild interests. And as I was mentioning, that's why I think if you have a diversity of people on the panels and on the task force, you're going to get a more well-rounded instrument, right? What's that saying? Never ask a barber if you need a haircut, a psychologist if you need psychotherapy, or a psychiatrist if you need medication. So the guild interests are another inevitable part of what it means to be human. I wouldn't trust a guideline on psychotherapy if it was written by all psychologists. You need methodologists. You need more than just content experts. You need people who don't have skin in the game in terms of what they're recommending. And then in terms of the explosion of diagnoses, there was a really interesting article that came out a couple months ago called The Prevalence Paradox. And one of the things that the authors pointed out is that in other areas of medicine, other than mental health, when you have good treatments, then the prevalence of the disorders goes down, right? Antibiotics, it would be a paradigmatic example. Infectious diseases, bacterial infections went way down. Real game changer for humanity. We don't see that in the mental health field. We have more treatments, but we have increasing number of people with the disorders. Now, I think the reason for that is multi-determined. It's certainly not just related to industry and conflicts of interest. I think, you know, social media has played a significant role, particularly in the increase of ADHD diagnoses. And there's this part of the zeitgeist now, I think, is many people are encouraged to identify with the disorders in a way that I don't know is necessarily helpful for humanity.
Just a big picture thought is that, Lisa and I played an important role in this, but there were also others as well. So also want to shout out for Lauren Davis. So there was students at Geisinger Commonwealth School of Medicine. There were also students at UMass Boston who played a key role at collecting and double checking and triple checking this information and writing and making this publication happen.
It's clear from reading it how much effort went into it. And, you know, I'm so glad to see it in such a well-read place as the British Medical Journal. So, you know, thank you both for taking some time to explain what you've done. And when the DSM-6 comes around, then, you know, I hope you do get to both do this again. And, you know, we'll see what transpires from that.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So I just want to thank Lisa and Brian so much for joining me today. And if you'd like to know more about their work, you can find a link to the paper in the post that accompanies this interview on madinamerica.com. So as always, thank you for listening. And until next time, take care. Thank you for listening to the Mad in America podcast. For more news, views, and updates, visit madinamerica.com.